Thank you for joining us. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod. If you are the generous sort, you can support the show through Patreon with either a recurring or one-time donation. If that isn't really your thing, you can also purchase Fisheries Pod shirts, hoodies, stickers, and face masks on our Teespring store, if you feel inclined. So check it out. Our guest today is Adam Searles. Adam is a fourth-generation Floridian from Brevard County. He decided to pursue marine ecology to solve the environmental issues plaguing the nearby Indian River Lagoon system. He graduated from the University of Central Florida in 2019, where he studied the response of macroinvertebrate communities to oyster reef restoration. He also worked with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission's Fisheries Independent Monitoring Program to investigate fish habitat relationships in the Indian River Lagoon. Adam was awarded the NOAA Hauling Scholarship, through which he investigated the habitat preference of an ecologically important shrimp species in Biscayne Bay. Adam is interested in learning how habitat type, quality, and quantity shapes the assembly of marine organisms. His diverse interests also include fisheries ecology, invasive species ecology, climate change and tropicalization, among others. Adam is currently a second-year PhD National Science Foundation Graduate Research Fellow in the School of Natural Resources and Environment at the University of Florida. His dissertation is focused on identifying the ecological mechanisms driving observed community-level differences between seagrass and microalgae-dominated habitats. Well, welcome to the show, Adam. I really enjoyed looking through your CV and kind of just getting to see all the projects you've been working on. But I think before we get into that, I'd love to hear what inspired you to get into marine ecology.
Yeah, so I'm from Brevard County, Florida, specifically Palm Bay, Florida, which is right along the Indian River Lagoon, which is, you know, its claim to fame is the most biodiverse estuary in North America. So I grew up in, you know, when I was a kid, you know, it was full of life. It was in, you know, relatively good condition, you know, sprawling seagrass beds, great fisheries. But as I grew older, we start having more and more harmful algal blooms, fish kills, you know.
Yeah.
Drives by the river to go, you know, my doctor was beachside. But that sounds really bougie. trust me, it wasn't. But, you know, if you know, even just going to the beach, you know, drives by the river, you know, went from really pretty to really smelly and, you know, hard to bear. So I kind of became interested in that. And, you know, I loved fishing. I grew up fishing Sebastian Inlet for snook and, you know, whatever else, you know, frequents the area as they pass through. So those two things combined kind of just inspired me to get involved in marine biology. You know, I didn't, you know, going into college, I didn't really know what research was. I just knew professors did marine biology and I wanted to do marine biology. So that was as far as I had thought ahead about it, but it worked out. I wanted to help out the Indian River Lagoon. That's the main driver.
Yeah, that makes sense. Just sort of seeing what was going on in your backyard. And then, I mean, I guess I think that happens a lot. A lot of the people I talk to who are kind of more our age, like early career, tend to be like, I had no idea about research, and then just sort of followed my interests, and next thing you know, that's all I was doing. I feel and the same way for sure, that it was
exactly.
Kind of didn't realize that was a job.
I mean, it sounds weird thinking about it now, but even in high school, you think of scientists, you still think of like lab coats and like test tubes, and like that's not I would have never guessed there was people who go out and pull nets and ID fish and get to, you know, see cool things all day.
Science can look very different.
That's what research is, though. And, you know, I'm glad I found my way here because I love it.
No, that's awesome. And I mean, it looks like from just sort of the rundown I got on everything you've done, you sort of hit the ground running when you got into research. Would you mind is walking me through the highlights of your undergrad research, and also maybe briefly say where you went to undergrad and stuff.
Yeah. So I went to undergraduate at the one of the great, I'll say one of the greatest universities in this country, and that's the University of Central Florida, UCF. Yeah, so it's about an hour and a half away from my hometown. That really didn't have anything to do with why I went there. I was ready to go off, but it just, I had such a gut feeling about it, that it was the right place to be. I never even toured the campus.
I toured one. Just like, I know what I'm doing. This is it.
Yep. No, that was literally it. As I was filling out applications, I was doing the application. I was like, this is the place. This is where I'm going. Mm-hmm. Awesome. But yeah, it worked out great. I love UCF. I still love it. But yeah, I started undergraduate there in the fall of 2015. Again, didn't know what research was. I knew I wanted to do marine biology. I knew professors did marine biology, you know, whatever that meant in my mind at the time. So I kind of, I just started going to professors' offices fall of freshman year. And, you know, a lot of people said, wow, that's really bold. And, you know, someone said stupid. That's what I did. You know, I didn't know any better. That's what I did. I just showed up at their offices every once in a while. You know, I kind of went online, looked at a list of professors I wanted to work with, started showing up at their offices, expressing my interest. And it really worked out that the professor that does the thing that I'm most interested in, you know, that most closely aligns with my interests, was brand new that semester as well. So didn't have anyone in his lab.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was Jeff Cook at UCF. Yeah, I kind of just showed up at his office and was like, hey, do you have a place in your lab? I would like to do marine biology, please. That's probably basically what it sounded like to him. Yeah. But yeah, I just kind of kept following up, and you know, he didn't have it in his lab. So he's like, yeah, let's get you involved. So he kind of helped me get in contact with Rich Paperno at FWC Fisheries Independent Monitoring in Melbourne, you know. So an FWC lab in my hometown, working on the Indian River Lagoon, doing fishery stuff. And he, that helped me secure an internship for that following summer, you know, a research internship. And so like, what the heck, that's like the perfect, most beautiful opportunity that I could have like stumbled upon.
Yeah. I think
stumbled
amazing.
Upon is a good, term a good for, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I went up the rest of freshman year. I didn't really get involved in research during the school year, but that next summer I, you know, started my own project with FWC there, and I kind of looked at some of the habitat fishery species relationships present in the Indian River Lagoon. I focused specifically on pinfish and spotted sea trout, and pinfish were the main focus, but we found that in air, so they were heavily associated with seagrasses throughout the lagoon, obviously. Pinfish being the seagrass obligates they are. But we found that in areas of the lagoon where seagrass die-offs were the worst, they actually started displaying secondary preference for mangroves, which was really interesting. And that's, you know, it was my first project. That's kind of where it stopped, just with those simple analyses. We never moved to the publication phase. You know, I presented it at a few conferences.
Yeah.
I won a few awards for it. The Indian River Lagoon Symposium was, I think, I won. Outstanding student presentation for that one. But yeah, it was really really good first experience. You know, I gained a lot of skills, like the fish ID, you know, otolith removal, genetic tissue sampling. Those are really just valuable skills. And to have that stuff early on really was what kind of rocketed me toward, you know, upwards towards other opportunities.
Excellent. And it's kind of neat too that I guess those, since sort of, I guess your first marine ecology observations were in that same system and you had interest and questions about that place, to come back and get your start there is really cool.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I really, you know, I grew up on the Indian River Lagoon, but it really gave me a more thorough understanding of the ecology and, you know, some even the management practices that go into, you know, regulating use of the lagoon and you know, conservation practices, etc.
Yeah. And was that work pretty field intensive, or maybe a mixture of mostly?
Oh yeah, you know, I was probably in the field 3 or 4 days a week. And it's like all day field days on the boat. And you know, I was the young kid, so my back was still good.
I was
pulling nets. Yeah.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's such a good intro to it as well, though, to get the incredibly hands-on side and then also get to present sort of the full like circle or all the ways that science could go. That's cool that you got both from that experience.
Yeah, and I hadn't thought about it at the time. You know, in my mind, I was just counting fish for an internship, and I was like, I got to do this to move up. But in reality, it the skills I got there, I try to think now about other opportunities I would have had where I would have gotten, like, one, that many skills, and two, like, the quality of the skills I received, like fish ID, otolith removal. You know, I got to remove otoliths on every single game species we caught.
Wow.
And so that was something that, like, you know, as a freshman, I had more experience than some graduate students doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I consider myself really lucky that that was my first
experience. Yeah, that's amazing. Plus, I mean, just the value of actually getting to, you know, work directly with the system of interest, I think, is always something that's important, like actually grounding any research you're doing in like natural history observations, I think is cool.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. And you know, the FWC is very, very management and fisheries oriented, that work does allow you to ask those natural history questions, to think about, you know, to think about the system in that context. And that's where I think a lot of, I get inspired by that kind of stuff. You know, a lot of my stuff is more fisheries, but the natural history questions and the simple ecology questions, I think, are still what inspires a lot of, you know, management questions or even questions we pursue.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Unless you have more to say about that, I was going to ask about the next piece of your undergrad research. You also earned a Noah Hawling scholarship. So I was wondering if you could describe your work as a Hawling scholar, and then also maybe outline the process of getting into that sort of thing. Since I think for many students who were like us at one point, where they did not know what research was and then suddenly learning all the opportunities that are out there, I think it might be useful to, I guess, sort of describe that.
Yeah, for sure. Process. Yeah. So I can talk about this because this is kind of the next step, and then I can go on to the other undergrad stuff. I didn't mean to get sidetracked from the original undergraduate research question.
Yeah, no worries. All good.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So it actually is very nice natural progression through my story, because then after that internship with FWC, I came back to UCF, you know, the fall of my sophomore year. And that's when Hawling's applications start. It's open only to sophomores. So one of my lab mates, because now Jeff had a fully formed lab, who was also an undergraduate, she was a year older than me. She sent me it and said, hey, you should apply for this. You know, you're eligible.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about it, and I wasn't really that on board, because, you know, me still not understanding research and, you know, the opportunities available to you and, you know, what you have to do to build a resume. I wasn't all about it at first, but then, you know, that's, I feel like I learned a lot about research and the graduate school process that semester. So then I looked at the opportunity again, and I was like, oh shoot, I should apply for this. So I did. I had a help from, one, the school's, what were they call it? The, you know, the career opportunities office. They helped me with resume and, essay. But then Jeff also helped me, you know, made recommendations on my essay. And fortunately for me, again, stumbling into the right place, he used to review applications for this program when he worked for NOAA.
Oh, wow. That's
yeah. So I had a pretty good, he was
like an eye on the inside.
Yeah, exactly. And then so he wrote a rec letter, and then I had another professor write a rec letter. And then I submitted it, and I wound up getting it somehow, just out of nowhere. It was kind of scary. That was the time of government shutdown. So we actually found out several months late. We got it, but I got it. And it was awesome. But I actually, and so I can come back to that, the rest of that, if you like, if you want me to go into the rest of the undergraduate stuff, then come back to it and like natural.
Yeah, I think that sounds great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Chronological is always good.
Yeah. If I don't do it that way, I can't remember.
No, exactly. That works.
But yeah. So that sophomore year while I was applying for that award, you know, I came back to UCF. I had all these new skills I got from FWC, and Jeff, who had a newly formed lab, you know, in his first cohort of graduate students, he was on a big NSF grant looking at the ecological impacts of oyster reef restoration. And he asked me, he had me involved in a few literature reviews. I was doing some genetic sampling of Atlantic croaker for him on a collaboration mm-hmm. project that still hasn't been written up.
All those ongoing manuscripts.
it'd be like that. Yeah, he said kind of the following spring, he asked me, he was like, "Hey, Adam, would you be interested in a paid opportunity in my lab this coming summer? It'll kind of be a leadership position teaching people stuff." And I said, "Heck yeah.
Yeah,
that sounds awesome." Yeah, so I was able to teach a bunch of people, some research technicians, some graduate students, all about fish ID. You know, the nets we were using were the exact same methods FWC mm-hmm. uses, so I was able to teach people that.
Yeah.
Some boating and trailering stuff. My dad, and another reason I got into marine biology is my dad was a boat mechanic for a mm-hmm. huge part of his life, so we always had boats. So I grew up, you know, around trailers, trailing boats, you know, boating, mm-hmm. stuff like that. So I was able to teach people some of that stuff, which was also a great opportunity because it kind of made me realize how much I enjoyed teaching.
Yeah.
But yeah, so as part of that effort, I started my undergraduate honors thesis, which was looking at the impact of oyster reef restoration on invertebrates dwelling on oyster reefs.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically what the project was is we had restored oyster reefs as the treatment, but then we also had a positive and negative control, those being, I just saw a huge fish in the pond out my window. And I don't know what it was.
Oh, that is a valid reason to get distracted. Yeah. It's actually
obligatory
on topic.
Yeah. What the heck is that?
Yep.
Oh, it's a cormorant underwater. That's what it is.
Oh, sweet.
Or an anhinga, actually.
Also fun.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
I know, I always call them cormorants, and then I'm like, no.
Yeah, that was the most fish-like anhinga I've ever seen. Anyway.
That's so funny. They do kind of sometimes look like snakes, if you're not paying attention, that long neck.
Yeah, well, I think he was sideways, so one of his wings looked like the dorsal, and one looked like the caudal. Anyway, where was I?
Oyster reefs.
Yes.
Positive and negative controls. Yep.
Yeah. So we had positive controls, which were live reefs, and negative controls, which were dead oyster reefs. So, and we sampled these over a period of 2 years. It wound up being like a little more than quarterly that we sampled. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so we could see the restoration trajectory of these oyster or these invertebrate communities on oyster reefs, and we could compare them to like live and dead states over time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just cut to the chase now. Oyster reef restoration works. You see really clear trends in terms of species diversity, species composition of the communities, as well as like single species indicators.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're actually getting ready to publish that or like submit it for publication.
Ooh, exciting.
Yeah.
Nice.
So I am really excited about that one right now in particular. But yeah, so I started that work that summer. The summer was great. We had a lot of fun. Learned a lot of new stuff about the system. This oyster reef work was in Mosquito Lagoon, which is a different part of the Indian River Lagoon. So again, in my home system, learning more mm-hmm. about its ecology, which was great.
Very full circle. That's cool.
Yeah, so then towards the end of that summer, I flew off to my Hollands meeting. So mm-hmm. they the first summer, they fly everyone up to meet everyone and do orientation. It's a week in DC. You meet all the other scholars, which is great. That was one of the most fun points of my undergraduate career, is meeting all those people. I'm still friends with a lot of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, we all got to know each other. We kind of saw what opportunities were available to us. Yeah, so it was a really just fulfilling, like, wholesome experience, which I still, like, cherish to this day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, then I flew back, finished off the summer, started my, it would be in the fall semester of my junior year. So at that point, I think internships opened. I was still working on samples for my oyster reef stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I looked at opportunities as they opened for the Holland Scholarship. They opened that fall in October. Yeah. And at the time, I wanted to attend graduate school at UM, University of Miami.
Oh, it's the cane.
Rosenstiel. Yeah, exactly. So they have a cooperative institute with NOAA there. The Southeast Fishery Science Center is right across the street. So I looked at working with Joe Serafi down in the Southeast Fishery Science Center. Yeah. And it worked out. So that's where I was ready to ship off to the following year, following Very summer. Cool. And yes, it was awesome. It was a great experience. I lived in Miami. I drove over the Rickenbacker Causeway to the Southeast Fishery Science Center every day. Nice. Yeah. And so my research there kind of, they're part of the comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, which I can never say correctly the first time.
That's a mouthful. So
And so they wanted me to do something with that. So they gave me their long-term monitoring data set, which was, they do the Biscayne Bay ecological monitoring. Mm-hmm. And I started to become interested in some of the relationships between seagrass and grass shrimp, just because they're very, you know, ecologically important, good indicator species of habitat health.
Yeah.
So I noticed that when you look at the distribution models that, I believe Halle Dooley was, I can't even remember now, but the distribution of Halle Dooley played a significant role in determining their distribution, whereas Thalassia didn't. And that was interesting to me because you would think any seagrass would. So I kind of had a few hypotheses about why, and did some reading, and I decided I wanted to test, is this like a behavioral preference? Is there, you know, some benefit to them that it's, you know, the benefit's so strong that they would actually choose one or the other. So I actually did some lab trials. I did some laminar flow choice flumes to see if they could detect the smell of seagrass.
And
orient towards it and go towards it. So this work, I think, I don't know if it was pioneered, but it is famous from putting larval fish in these devices and you know, having one source be, you know, coral reef, and then one source just being, you know, open ocean with nothing in it, and then putting them in both of those waters into the flume, and then by laminar flow the chemistry of the waters won't mix, but the fish can swim between them. And so in theory they'll choose the one with coral reef. So I did the same exact thing with grass shrimp. And they chose, they didn't have a preference between species, but they did have a strong preference for seagrass over open water, just plain seawater. So you could actually see them, like they'd go in both sides of the flume, and they'd go over to the one without seagrass, and they immediately just go back to the seagrass one, and try to swim as far up the current as they could. Yeah, it was really cool.
That's so neat to see.
But yeah, in addition to living in Miami and seeing Rosenstiel and, you know, how NOAA works, which is a great opportunity. I love the people I worked with there. It was also my first time doing like lab-based experiments.
Yeah.
Which was another, that's why I told that whole story.
That's a cool opportunity because, you know, a lot of like what I do a lot is field-based, you know, and then just like big data sets. But that's cool to have a chance to, you know, get the critters you're studying into the lab and actually, you know, have a controlled experiment and like be able to manipulate factors. That's awesome.
Yeah, it taught me a lot about like thinking about how you're gonna you know, control stuff, you know, testing different types of controls, which was, you know, it was a great opportunity for me because now I'm looking at doing some lab stuff for my PhD. So at the end of that experience, I flew up to DC again and saw everyone, you know, for a second time. We all presented our results at like a symposium, another week long thing. And that, I think, you know, I talked about how the first time around was one of my best memories, but I think in terms of research, that symposium week in DC, I think was probably the most cherished part of undergraduate I had. Just I made so many friends there, and I still talk to these friends like regularly. I mean, they're all great people. They're all off in graduate school now doing different stuff.
Yeah,
but yeah, that's such a good group of people. If there's any sophomores listening to this, definitely apply for a Holland scholarship. <That's awesome. laughs> it'll change your career and your life. And I mean that. Probably the best opportunity I've had in my career was the Holland scholarship.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah. But yeah, so then I came back to UCF for my senior year, one more round. And again, back at processing again. Samples, back at it again, counting crabs. I spent the next year counting crabs. At this point, I think I had a publication under my belt. In our invertebrate samples, we found that an invasive species had spread northwards and was utilizing the oyster reefs of Mosquito Lagoon. And that species was Charybdis helleri, the Indo-Pacific swimming crab. So we put out a little note about that. And so that was my first taste of publication, how the process goes and everything.
Yes, that whole thing.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was, and to this day, I'm obsessed with that crab. Every single crab that comes on the boat here, and when I'm out in Cedar Key, I have to check to make sure
you're just watching for it.
Exactly. Because it's made its appearances throughout my life now. Like just, I'll be walking down, I'd be at a graduate school interview, like for example, at FIU where I interviewed. And I'd be walking along the hallways, off to wherever I was going next. Out of the corner of my eye, I'd see a picture of it on a poster. Or, I'd be on the FWC boat and, they'd dump a bucket full of crabs onto the table. And the one that would land in front of me was, a big old Charybdis helleri.
Yeah.
So I'm always looking out for it. Yeah. It's a little bit of a trigger almost.
That's so funny.
Always there, always waiting. Yeah. But so what else? Yeah. I mean, that most of that year was just processing samples. But at that point I had accrued enough awards, enough research scholarships within UCF to be competitive for what's called the Order of Pegasus at UCF, which is UCF's highest student award.
Yeah.
It's a high GPA.
Like a cool award. I like that it has that name.
Yeah, I know. Well, so our academic mascot is the Pegasus, and it's the seal of our university.
That
so.
Makes sense. But
yeah. Still the order of, yeah, yeah. It's a very regal sounding award.
It's like something if like you're a wizard.
Yeah, you're in the Order of Pegasus. I know the Order of the Phoenix, the Order of the Pegasus.
Yeah, exactly.
Same kind of thing. Yeah. But yeah, it's given to students who are, they win national awards, they bring national attention to UCF, good academics. Mm-hmm. And somehow I won it. I was inducted into the 2019 class, the Order of Pegasus.
Yeah, no, that's excellent.
And that was my dream. They have a what's called the Order of Peg Lounge in the Student Union at UCF, and it has pictures of every student ever inducted into it. And I remember sitting there sophomore year with a friend. I said, wow, I'd love to be in that someday. Just thinking, I'd never actually do it, but there I was.
Yeah, but here you are. No, that's so cool. And I mean, it's always, I think, fun to reflect back. The fact that you were saying that you just stumbled into things, or when you showed up, you didn't know what you wanted to do and that sort of thing. And then next thing you're in the Order of Pegasus.
Yeah. Life,
so it's, sometimes stumbling works.
Yeah. I stumbled the whole way, but somehow I was standing on that stage senior year.
Start bothering random professors next thing you know.
Yeah. And that was, I tell this to all the undergraduates I meet is, be bold, don't care about that kind of stuff. One of the reasons I think I got the Order of Pegasus is in my interview, I said, I made a joke about, being a stupid freshman, just showing up to professors' offices. And one of the committee people was like, oh, well, you said that in your essay. That's one of the things we admired about you is your boldness and how you really emphasized that throughout your career. And then, in the moment I was like taken back, and then I just went, yes. Boldness.
Good point.
Yes, that's what I was going for.
Yep, exactly. I wasn't just making a joke.
Yeah.
But I think that's true. That's something that I've, whenever anyone would come for me, like to get advice about, grad school, for instance, because that's a good one. All of my undergrad friends were like, how do I go about applying and stuff? I'm like, honestly, there's just a degree of comfort that you have to have with like bothering people and putting yourself out there, and don't worry about it, because send the email or take the meeting, it's always going to be worth it. Like the worst case scenario is that nothing comes of it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, if you're a freshman looking to get involved in research, you don't know how, literally just email, show up at office hours.
Yeah, it works.
Be annoying, basically. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's how I kind of got like my honors thesis rolling in undergrad too, is I just emailed some random professor I'd never met. I was like, hey, can I talk to you about this? And he was like, yeah. Honestly, I almost said no. And then I saw that the fish species you're studying is kind of cool. And like, you seemed pretty interested. So I was like, yeah, whatever. Come on down. It all worked out. So.
Yeah. And that's what Jeff Cook wound up saying to me my freshman year is, my senior year, he's like,
yeah,
you know, at first he was like, why is this freshman showing up to my office? Yeah. Do I want to deal with him? But he was like, you were persistent. You're the only one who kept up and, you know, exactly. Kept contacting me. So that's why you're here.
That boldness. Like, well,
yeah. Boldness, if you want to call it that.
That's awesome.
But yeah, I mean, I think those are the highlights of my undergraduate career. I had a few other projects I worked on. You know, I gathered so much data from that honors thesis, I actually wound up, I think I'm gonna get 3 pubs out of it, but 4 actually.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, but that remains to be seen.
Yeah, no, I mean, I feel that I'm still writing something up from my undergrad research, so it's
just, yeah,
it is the way it goes.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it takes several years to get even just the simplest paper out.
Yep, exactly. So I guess, yeah, I think that was a great walkthrough of everything. And
yes, sorry if it was lengthy.
No, that's, I enjoyed it. I think people will enjoy it too. Okay, so, and it's fun to get that detail. I think it, you know, anyone listening will find something interesting in that. So,
mm-hmm.
But yeah, I figure now we can move on to your current research. So we met because we're both PhD students at the University of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be awesome if you could describe, you know, the systems you study, the questions that you're pursuing, and then I guess what impact you'd like to see your dissertation have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is you wrote these questions beautifully because they're very chronological. Because this one actually connects to, you know, the end of undergraduate, then my gap year, and then, you know, being in my PhD. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my experience with undergraduate research doing all the oystery stuff, you know, habitat really affirmed that, you know, habitat, you know, I call it habitat science or habitat ecology is what I'm really interested in, these foundation species and their relationship with the organisms that live in them. Mm-hmm. So I took a gap year and I worked for FWC Fisheries Independent Monitoring, where I had my first internship. Mm-hmm. Nice. And I was actually a paid employee going home for a year. You know, I wasn't super excited about it at first, but I said, hey, this will actually be a good opportunity. You know, I'll get to, you know, see my parents, my friends, whenever I want. I'll take a year, just take a break. So it did wind up being good. But yeah, going back to like the Indian River Lagoon being super like anthropogenically impacted, heavy eutrophication, you know, algal blooms, seagrass die-offs, 29 yards. In wake of all those horrible seagrass die-offs, the macroalgae Caulerpa, specifically Caulerpa prolifera, has really taken over. And in places where there used to be sprawling halidule beds, there's now just like mats, like forests of this macroalgae. And it's like knee deep in some places. And it's not, it's not like a tall growing species. It's actually a pretty short species. It's just so matted up on top of each other.
Yeah.
That it's so dense and thick and it's everywhere. And so there's been a few studies in that system and elsewhere specifically that have showed that the communities that inhabit Caulerpa versus seagrasses are not equal. They're not the same. They have different trophic structures entirely, different species that thrive in them. And so, I began to wonder why and started to realize, you know, we don't really know why the communities here are different. So that's what I wanted to do for my dissertation.
Yeah.
And so
just answer that why question.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So I got into UF and it was a position with a seagrass ecologist and a fisheries habitat ecologist as my co-advisors. I was like, this is literally perfect.
Perfect.
Yeah. So, you know, in one of my first meetings with them after I accepted, I kind of brought this idea to them, and they were like, yeah, that sounds really interesting. Yeah, let's pursue this. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, my first instinct was to work in the lagoon, which I still am doing one of my chapters over there, but
yeah,
they were like, we need to expand out of the lagoon for you. I'm like, okay, fine, fair.
It's like, sure.
Yeah. So I'm actually doing most of my field work now in Crystal River, you know, working on one chapter, which is quantifying those community differences, because we want to quantify the differences in like specific to our field site before we go into the why. And hopefully that data will inform the why, like inform future chapters, future
experiments. Give a solid groundwork for what's actually going on.
Yeah. So we use benthic sleds, beam trawls, seagrass cores, some, they're called epifauna samples, but they're like a spat bag sample of the seagrass. To measure like the seagrass density and biomass, and compare that to like the invertebrate and fish abundance that we catch. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to quantify those differences on a gradient of 100% seagrass to 100% caulerpa and everything in between. The hope would be, and that's down in Crystal River. We're talking about expanding to other estuaries. I'd love to do like a coast-to-coast comparison, either the Indian River Lagoon versus Crystal River. I think that'd be really interesting.
That would be really cool.
Yeah. But the hope is that, you know, my PhD answers the why, you know, why are they different? Because if, you know, it's not looking so good for our estuaries down here, you know, Tampa Bay has been a successful restoration, but like Charlotte Harbor, Indian River Lagoon, especially, you know, if this keeps eutrophication keeps happening, getting worse, you know, we're going to see more and more macroalgae blooms like this. And what's that going to do to the fisheries, you know, the other ecosystem services that seagrasses provide? They're going to change entirely. And so understanding the why they're different is really important for managing those ecosystem service changes, understanding what's going to happen to them. Because one of the theories is that caulerpa, because of its secondary metabolites, doesn't actually contribute that much to fisheries productivity. So you would in theory see huge changes in fisheries productivity.
That would be a pretty fundamental shift.
Yes, it would, and it's kind of scary, and so I want to help us understand the why, so hopefully we can have a better idea of what could happen.
Yeah, that's a huge deal. I mean, I know, like, I myself work with a fish species that spends part of their life as, you know, little baby gag in the estuaries, and they're you know, they make use of the seagrass like so many other species do. So scary to think, I guess, what could happen. Change. So
thankfully the West Coast, which is where I think you do most of your work, is actually in pretty good shape.
Love that.
Crystal River,
it's still it's just an interesting idea, you know, that so much could change from something that I think maybe people don't notice that much.
It is scary, because like people don't realize, I mean, some people do, they know the difference, but a lot of people don't. They just see it and they're like, oh, cool, seagrass. But in reality, it's like, you know, macroalgae is natural, and it, you know, it hosts important communities, but in such high abundance, it's kind of like almost a menace, and like and if it gets, you know, abundant enough, it's going to be a threat to those people's livelihoods, you know.
Is there anything else you have to say on that one?
I guess the other thing to say is one of my chapters that's in the lagoon is on the polar expansion of a
I did want to talk more about this.
I think this is actually the most relevant of my research to the fisheries podcast, so maybe it would be good to talk about.
Probably true.
So that chapter is about the poleward spread of the Western Atlantic sea bream if you're from up north. My FWC collaborators are from up north, my UF lab are all Southerners, so I'm just constantly wrong.
You're caught in the middle.
Yeah. Right. But Western Atlantic sea bream. They're actually really cryptic species. Is really not much is known about them. They're supposed to be abundant from New Jersey throughout the Caribbean, but they're also known as a tropical species. But the data, there's no data there to support that New Jersey claim. Not even in South Carolina, they've never even observed it. So we think that just might be wrong, and they are truly a tropical species. But yeah, they're really common in the Caribbean. They're a huge herbivore. They eat algaes and seagrasses. But that's really all that's known about them. We don't have any like age, length to age estimates, any relationships like that quantified. Even their diets aren't super well studied, which is, I think, the most studied part of them. But either way, so in the past 10 years or so, FWC FIM in Melbourne has noticed a 49-fold increase in their abundance in the northern Indian River Lagoon. Yeah, like insane.
yeah, they've arrived.
Yeah, they have. They, wow. Which is, yeah, it's, and you know, I remember as a as an intern, and that would be the summer of 2016, you know, we caught them. I knew the difference. They look just like a pinfish. They're actually hard to tell apart if you don't have them side by side. But you know, I remember catching a few of them, and then, you know, when I came there in my gap year, we were getting them left and right. So like the difference is even noticeable for someone who's been there that long. But yeah, and so at the same time, sheep's head are have declined sixfold in the same amount of time. Yeah, so the interesting part of this system is that, unlike anywhere else in the world to our knowledge, sheep's head are herbivores in the northern Indian River Lagoon. Their guts are dominated by green algae, red drift algae, and seagrass, whereas in other parts of the range, it's all, you know, small invertebrates, barnacles, the stuff you'd expect.
I know, I was gonna say, with those like crushing teeth and stuff.
Yeah, it's really strange. And my theory would be it's a, you know, a system dependent thing. You know, the IRL historically is a seagrass dominated system, so maybe it just makes more sense for, you know, omnivores to eat more seagrass. But even that, you know, there's no seagrass around now, but they still eat the, you know, vegetation.
Their diets,
it's such a weird like anomaly almost that it's hard to like, it's almost hard to like hypothesize what's going on because it's so random. So weird. But either way, so we're hypothesizing that, you know, the rise of seabream could, so seabream could be, you know, increasing competition for these declining sheep's head, and, you know, at the worst, you know, be a contributing factor to their decline. So the project involves one, it's kind of a population dynamics, not like modeling, but just basic like time series. We've done some hotspot analysis over time to show the actual statistical spread. And it has been a significant poleward spread if you look at the hotspot analysis between like 10, 20 years ago and like the past 5 years. And so that publication is getting ready to be pumped out. And that was while I was at FWC. And then the second part, which is one of my chapters in my dissertation, is a gut content and stable isotope study, kind of trying to quantify their niche, quantify overlap with the stable isotopes, describe their diet, see, you know, are there differences? And so far the data says, just the preliminary gut content data says, no, there isn't really a difference. There's a ton of overlap. They both most commonly eat red drift algae, which I guess isn't a surprise given how much of it there is. But yeah, one of our, an important point is one of our hypotheses was that the rise of Caulerpa that I talked about earlier was like facilitating this species. So maybe they're eating it since they do like regularly eat algaes. And in the pop dye paper, the rise of the correlation between seabream abundance and Caulerpa was like correlation, the R squared was like 0.75 or something like that, which is insane. It's insane for like you know, ecology. So we were like, oh, maybe there is a relationship here, but they aren't eating it. They're not eating it at all. I found maybe one blade in one stomach. And then they're not recruiting to it because we still have not found any juvenile seabream in the in the lagoon whatsoever. So
that's so interesting.
So the mystery kind of deepens here is, you know, they're eating the same things, but the reason for their rise has not been revealed yet.
Oh, that's very cool. People will have to stay tuned to find out.
Have me on it for
part two in a few years. Dr. Adam,
Oh, hopefully.
It is neat though, also, I guess, that you've had such a long-term interaction with that system to like know it so well and then be able to bring that knowledge forward to this project. That's really neat.
Yeah, I mean, that's the dream, right? That's why I started it all.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. Hopefully I can do it more in the future, but get over there some. We'll see.
Yep. Well, I guess, unless you have anything else to add, that kind of brings us to the end of the tough part of the interview. So we can get into those final five questions that we ask every guest.
Okay, cool.
And the first one is, what is your favorite fish?
Man.
Yeah, it changes day to day, you know.
I know. So do I have to choose one, or can I have a fresh water or a salt water?
I will allow it. I think that's okay. Totally fine.
It's like asking, you know, trying
to pick your favorite child or something. So
yeah, exactly,
feel free. Exactly. You can have like five, but fresh and salt, we'll do that. That's perfect.
Okay. I'll do one fresh and one salt. My favorite salt water would be just a pinfish, just the basic
classic
pinfish. They're pretty, they got personality. Yep. Habitat dependent, good indicators, and my first project was on them.
That makes sense. I like them even though they've stabbed me so many times.
Yeah, I for me it's the sheep's head. The sheep's head get me way more often than the pinfish. Yeah, I like the pinfish even though they but that's the personality. You know, I'd want to stab someone
exactly
if, you know, a giant picked me up.
No, for sure, if I was being abducted, like that's a good one.
I love my finfish. And so then my favorite freshwater would be smallmouth bass.
Nice.
Yeah. I grew up fishing in Maine. My family takes vacations there regularly. And so that's what I fish for. They're beautiful animals.
Maine is large... the best.
Yeah, they're absolutely beautiful. Largemouth is, you know, too popular, too mainstream for me.
Yeah, exactly. You got to be alternative.
Exactly.
Smallmouth here. That's cool. Yeah, that's a good one. I know it's hard because that's the thing is I feel like I obviously focus a lot on saltwater systems, but I grew up, you know, in the Midwest and it's all, you know, fishing in freshwater. So
yeah,
you got to give them some love.
Has anyone ever asked you what your favorite fish is?
Yes, actually, I got interviewed. God, I don't know how many episodes ago that was. And I'm gonna assume that I probably said gag just because. No, I know what I said. Actually, I said mummy chog.
That's a cool tip.
It's like quick pivot, those little mud minnows. But it's like, you know, love gag, obviously, because I think about them every day, all the time.
I think about them a lot.
I have no choice but to love them, otherwise I would hate them. But you know, and I liked cobia, which I studied in my undergrad, just because they're delicious and fun to fish for, and
cool animals too.
I also think they're just neat. But yeah, I gotta say mummy chogs because I've worked with them a few different times. I guess they're kind of like the crab that's stalking you for me, because they keep reappearing just throughout what I'm working on. You know, I studied them for a class and like, you know, did some like just little projects with them, you know, and then I use them as bait for a lot of my stuff in North Carolina. And I also like elastomer tagged some of them to do like marker capture work with them in culverts, like by the road. So like they just keep coming back and I can't escape them, but I don't want to. So, but yeah, that was like a long aside about my favorite fish.
No, it's all good. I was curious.
Yeah, I know. Now you know more about me.
Yeah.
I'd have to think what my favorite freshwater fish is, though. TBD. We'll come back to that.
All right. I'll ask you next half the hour.
Yeah, exactly. Next one when we return to discuss your future results. We'll talk about my freshwater fish. Cool. Well, the next question is, what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
I've got so many. I mean,
yeah, this one is also fun if you were like a favorite field memory, a favorite professional memory or whatever. I'm open to, you know, variation. Yeah. So
I said meeting, you know, getting together with all the Holland scholars the second time earlier. So I'll tell a story, a field story this time.
Love it.
We were doing some shark tracking offshore of Cape Canaveral over on the East Coast, Brevard County, where I'm from. And we used this gill net that it actually sits on the bottom. It sinks to the bottom, but it has floats to keep it upright.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like a 400 foot. It's like a big one because, you know, we're offshore. So we said that we leave it for 20 minutes. We come back and, you know, I'm the young undergrad. Adam pulling it in.
Okay.
Yep. So I'm pulling it in, bringing it in. And, you know, this is like in 50 plus feet. You know, I'm staring into the abyss, pulling it in. And I'm like not even halfway. This thing pulled in. I feel the whole net just shake like back and forth, like, and this is like on the bottom. I can feel it all the way up. I'm like, something big on here.
Yeah, it's like, I think there's a
there's something massive.
The sea monster in this net.
Exactly. That's kind of what I was getting at. And the professor's like, just pull it in, Adam. It's fine. It's fine. Just pull it in. I'm like, okay.
Like, all right.
So I'm pulling it in. I'm pulling it in. And then, I, you know, it's fighting me at this point, like really hard, but I keep pulling. And I see a giant fin just splash, almost break the surface, like trying to push down. I'm like, oh, geez, it's a giant ray. So I keep pulling. And out of the water comes probably like a 6 foot long rostrum.
And wow.
It's a giant sawfish.
That is incredible.
I'm like, oh. Oh, oh. And so I'm the only one who can see it because I'm at the front of the boat looking over the side. And my friend was like, Adam, use your words. What is it? I'm like,
there's no words.
I know. And so he like puts it in neutral and he comes to the front of the boat and looks over and then he starts going, oh. And so it was like a 12-foot sawfish.
Wow.
It was massive.
Yeah, so that was a very good memory. That's so cool.
Yeah, so the good part is we were able to easily cut it free and it swam off, no harm done. But like,
excellent.
You know, it was on my bucket list to see a sawfish in the wild, and I did it. And the thing was massive. I never thought I'd see that one that big, you know?
Yeah, that's so crazy. I mean, also just such a surprise sighting.
I know. We were looking for like this hammerheads, like 2 feet long, if that.
Yeah. Wow.
And, yeah.
That is very cool.
Insane.
I'm only slightly jealous.
Yeah, that's a good story. It always does well at social gatherings.
Yes, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I know, you gotta have those. Be like, all right, so I'm a marine biologist. Let me.
What are your stories? Well.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
Sweet. Well, I guess we can roll on to the next one.
Mm-hmm.
So this one. And the following, they're kind of similar, but we'll start with this one. So if you could pick any job or location or both, like what would be your dream job?
Yeah. So hands down, it'd be professor at UCF.
Nice.
Like not
you
even.
You know what you want.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I mean, you know, I love my alma mater. I love the area. You know, I love the system. They do a lot of work in the lagoon. But being in Orlando, they also have easy access to the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of good marine biology work going on there. It'd just be everything about it would be perfect for me.
Yeah.
So cool. UCF administration, if you're listening to this.
Yep. We got one for you. He's coming.
Yeah. Whether you like it or not.
Yep, exactly. No, that's so great. Well, they would be lucky to have you.
Thank you. I have to trick them somehow.
Yep, you'll do it.
Hopefully.
So the next question, similar but different to the last one, is if money was not a thing and we don't live within the normal confines of academia, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Yeah, that's a hard one because like my interests are so broad. I want to do so many things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess my dissertation technically, because you know I came up with it. I've been wondering this for a while.
Yeah.
It'd probably have to do something to do with, you know, lagoon restoration of seagrasses, you know, finding some magical way to restore seagrasses in a way that are like resilient or resistant to, you know, die-offs driven by eutrophication.
Yeah.
And then doing like habitat, how that relates to fisheries and you know, how that restoration impacts fisheries in the long run, something like that.
Yeah. So it'd kind of be like your dissertation plus extra.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
I mean, something like that. I've got a lot of ideas of really cool projects for the future. A lot of them about oyster reefs or different habitats. The question will probably have to do with habitat.
Yep.
That might be the best answer I can give.
Yeah, a habitat question.
Yeah.
Yep. Perfect. All right. Well, that brings us to the very last question. So if there was one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, and this can be, you know, ecology related or not, what would that point or principle be?
Man.
Yeah, this one's like actually a very difficult question.
It is, because like I have two written down. I could go ecologically or I could go otherwise, like you just said.
I mean, we're all for wisdom here. So if you have both, we'll take them.
Okay. You said both?
Yeah.
I think ecologically, what not just scientists, but everyone on the planet needs to keep in mind is you can never do just one thing. That's one of the maxims of ecology that we learned in undergraduate, you know. Every action we have, every management decision, every way we impact the environment has some unknown consequence just because of the, you know, infinite complexity of nature. So when we, you know, when we make decisions on how we treat nature or treat a system, we need to make sure we think about what the impacts could be. Even if, you know, we think they're going to be small, they can wind up being big just because of our poor understanding of ecology in general. And then personally, I'd say, especially in academia, you know, I've worked in a lot of places, NOAA, FWC, UCF, UF now. I think kindness is really important, empathy, those type of things. So even if you have no reason to be, you know, understanding or nice or actively friendly towards someone, it's really important to do. It's going to benefit you and everyone else in the long run. You're going to be a better scientist because of it, because you're going to have more opportunities to collaborate with people because they're going to want you on your team. You're going to build people up and they're going to do better, and that's going to be better for you.
Yeah, nice. I think that's great. Both of those are excellent points. And I think, you know, great to take into account when you're approaching the world, even, you know, outside of ecology, it's important. But that is great. It's more fun to do research with nice people.
it really is. Like, you know, if you're nice, it's just going to be better for you in the long run. Because like you said, if you're a nice person, they're going to have fun with you and they're going to want you on their team in the future. You know, you never know who's going to be the next Campana or Thoreau or, you know, whoever. True. It could be one of us. It could be one of our colleagues now. Yeah. But, you know, you want to be on the good side, you know. Right now, I would, you know, if you or I become the next Thoreau or whatever, you know, I think we'd enjoy working with each other. Whereas if we were jerks to each other, you know, the other one would never have the opportunity to work with the next Thoreau.
You would not want to be on the podcast.
No, exactly. Yeah. Nope. Yeah. If I was a jerk, I would not be here right now.
Awesome. Well, I think that is everything I have for you. So thank you so much for coming on the show. I really enjoyed getting to hear more about everything you've done.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. I've never been on a podcast before. I feel like an official scientist now.
I know, it's very fancy. Yeah, well, we'll have to bring you back and get the update.
Awesome. That sounds great.
If you want to find out more or get a hold of Adam, you can reach him by email at adamrosss@ufl.edu. Or find him on Twitter at @EcoloAdam. That's ecoloadam. If you would like to get a hold of me or the rest of the hosts, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at @FisheriesPod. Or by old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespod.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream them from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a monthly contribution through Patreon or by rocking some awesome Fisheries Podcast logo shirts, hoodies, and stickers available on Teespring. I'm Hannah. Thank you for listening to the 149th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember that nothing does just one thing, and kindness is always the way to go.